Our study has been occupied with the matter of dealing with sacrificing the eternal. And we think about the responsibilities that we have with the gospel. And, you know, if it doesn't matter what we believe, it doesn't matter if we believe. I mean, that's going to be a basic premise that we need to understand. And when we talk with individuals, and of course the assemblies are designed for the purpose of encouraging us within the work of what we're involved in, and that we'll be able to equip ourselves to be able to help others also. Peter identified to be ready always to give answer for the hope that is in you. And so that's what we want to do, and because of the individuals that we come into contact with, they need to know about the Lord and the responsibilities that are associated with that, in recognizing God's right to rule in our life, and not based upon what it seems like or what it feels like or what I think or whatever the case is. And so that's, you know, the reason why we spend our time within the Scriptures, is to allow God to instruct us in regards to what He would have us to know, what He would have us to do, and how it will help us to serve others in regard to it. And so that's where we are. We're looking at matters that we understand that this requires a personal sacrifice that's involved, to offer up spiritual sacrifice that's acceptable to the Lord, and to do so by presenting our bodies a living sacrifice. Under the law, the animals, that which was sacrificed, died. We live. We are a living sacrifice in regard to that, as opposed to what was under the law. In that it was a very bloody religion, if you will, in regard to it. They understood the importance of blood, that without the shedding of blood, there is no remission. And we find that Paul alluded to his death as that of an offering, that he was being poured out, and he did that for the gospel. So it's matter, there's two aspects of it. One of them, there's nothing of Christianity made simple. There's nothing that's easy about it. However, when you consider the consequences of not serving the Lord, then it's easy. It's not difficult when we understand that God would have us to develop a life that will benefit us now, godliness that's profitable for this life, and also that which is to come. And that's what we focus on. And hopefully that we will be able to bring glory to our God because we have died to sin, and that we'll be able to help others also, that they can see their, recognize and accept the fact that we really don't have the control of things here. The Lord's got them. He's ruled in the kingdom of men. He will continue to do so. And in our service to Him, that we will give Him the glory and the honor that's due unto Him. And so we're looking at this matter of, we'll look at a few specifics in regard to what the Lord would have us to be and have us to do. And we find our first one, or the one we're going to deal with this morning, deals with the matter of purity. We understand from what's defined that purity, that it denotes the chastity which excludes all impurity of spirit and manner or act, of that of being pure. You know what, if you add water, as to whether or not it's pure or whether or not it has contaminants in it. And so that's kind of the matter of what we want. We want our food to be pure, and we want it to be free of contaminants that would destroy us. And so when we're looking at life and the Lord's indication of a purity that we should maintain within our life, the Scriptures speak of this concept of purity, pure from every fault or immaculate. We want to be pure in the eyes of our God because that's what He created us to be. And so as we seek to be what God would have us to be, that we need to add this purity to our life. Paul said in the Philippian letter, Philippians chapter 4, verse 8 and 9, in regard to this matter of things to be added to life. And he kind of sums it up. There's two or three passages within the Scripture Peter identified of having our faith, of what it ought to be. And if you'll add this to your faith, you'll never fall. And so there's passages like that, as it is here in Philippians chapter 4, that gives us a simple, if you will, view in regards to it. He said, finally, brethren, whatsoever things are true, and deals with those matters of true to fact, conforming to reality. And so what is true? There's not my truth and your truth. There's God's truth. John 17 identifies when the Lord prayed for the apostles that God would sanctify or set them apart, sanctify them in truth, thy word is truth. And so it's not your truth or my truth. And that's what goes on in our society. Individuals have been told to seek your truth and you follow it. Seek your truth. Well, because there is a truth, there is an ultimate truth. And so in regard to it, that belongs to God. So he said that whatsoever things are true, whatsoever things are honorable, and it deals with this matter of being honorable within life, of reverence, that you show the proper reverence that it coincides with God's desires. Whatsoever things are just, and it deals with that matter of justice, and deals with that of what is right, what is true, of to be just. And when justice is lost, we see that society loses hope when we have within our officials where they're not just within what they do. You can't go to a court of law and hope to receive justice for the various criminal activities that may be brought against you or whatever the case may be. That we want a judge that is just and that will go by what the law says, not by what he feels or she or whatever the case is in regard to it. So whatever things are just and whatever things are pure, and the purity is only going to come from that of which God has manifested to us. And we find that James had dealt with that aspect of purity within his writing, the prophet James, in James chapter 3 and verse 17, when he said, but the wisdom that is from above is first pure. And so it deals pure without, it's free from defilement, is what he identifies. Then peaceable and gentle, easy entreated, full of mercy and good fruit, without variance, without hypocrisy. And so these are characteristics of life. We develop our characteristics, and that's what we are, of what our characters will develop into as a result of our obedience to the Lord. Now, God is not a respecter of persons, but he is a respecter of that of character and of conduct. And he's shown that throughout his dealings with Israel and also with that of the church. And so we're looking at this matter of purity. So Paul identified. He said, whatsoever things are true, whatsoever things are honorable, whatsoever things are just, whatsoever things are pure, whatsoever things are lovely, whatsoever things are of good report, if there be any virtue or any excellence in life, and if there be any praise, think on these things. The things which you both learned and received and heard and saw in me, these things do. That's what these are, being honorable and true and pure and lovely. And lovely is according to 1 Corinthians chapter 13 of what love is. Not what society thinks love is, but what it actually is, in the sense that whatever we do, whatever we express, is for the benefit of the recipient of it, and that deals with that. But you add those things to your life, and the God of peace shall be with you. And so think on those things, and that's what he's attempting to do. And so that's what we have of whatsoever things are pure. Look to life in regard to it. We find that we are to be an example of purity in that matter in 1 Timothy chapter 4 and verse 12, of where the Lord said, let no man, talking about Timothy. Timothy was a young man, and in relatively so. And as a rule, the older will look upon the younger that they've got a long way to go. They have a long, you know, life to live. We went to a gospel meeting one time and had a young man there that was preaching. He was probably early 20s, if somewhere along that way. And the audience to whom he was speaking was elderly. Most of them were elderly individuals that had been serving the Lord for years and what have you. And boy, he just let it loose. And I was thinking, you know, you're talking to the choir here. You know, you're talking to the choir. You're in regard to it. So it was kind of funny you know, what are you going to tell them? Well, you're not going to tell them anything. You can encourage them. And so it's usually the case that the benefit goes to the speaker more than it does to the hearer. I mean, that's just the nature of it. But he said, let no man despise you, because Timothy was going to have that problem as a young man, that they would look and they would despise him. And he said, so let no man despise thy youth. Well, you could have two different ways. Sometimes individuals say, you can't despise me just because I'm young. I won't let you despise me. No. What he said was that you don't let let no man despise thy youth. But here's how you keep that from happening. But be thou an example to them that believe in word, in manner of life, in love, in faith, in purity. Your characteristics. That's what is going to keep individuals, the elder that's been there, that has seen that, and what's going to allow them to not despise your youth is because your characteristics have developed to a point that they have nothing else to do but to honor the fact that you are serving the Lord. And so that's the matter. And in that, a part of that, like it was in Philippians chapter 4, that the manner of life in love and faith in purity. What he said, what he did, how he behaved, and how he dealt with other people. And so that was a matter of what the Lord identified. Also in Titus chapter 1, verse 15, it's interesting, I thought about this passage several concepts, but the Lord identified that, well, verse 13, this testimony is true, for which cause reprove them sharply. Now, the testimony is true was that all Cretans were liars, you know, and that was from one of their own prophets that said that. And he said, for which cause reprove them, that they may be sound in the faith. So those that were vain talkers and deceivers, those of the circumcisions, of whom Paul said whose mouths must be stopped, he said, you reprove them. Reproof is one of those matters of where, kind of like rebuke. It's a matter that it's not, they may be harsh from time to time, but it shows an individual's worth. They're worth something. If they weren't worth something, just let them go and let them do whatever they're going to do. But they have a worth. And so he said that you reprove them sharply, or in a manner actually that cuts. It cuts to the chase in regard to it. That, here's the result. That's all what we look at when we reprove or when we rebuke, of whatever it is, whether it's children, whether it's whoever it falls under that category, that correction needs to be given. The instruction needs to be given. And here's a case of those that were so entrenched in it that Paul told Titus that you do this and that you cut it short. It makes a cut. You get right to it. Not giving heed to Jewish fables. Now, the Jews had fables. They had stories of which they would tell of moral results that was with it. And that's what would be involved, storytelling regarding that. And he said, not giving the heed to Jewish fables and commandments of men who turn away from the truth. And so you don't give any leeway in regard to that. He said, to the pure, all things are pure, but to them that are defiled and unbelieving, nothing is pure. But both their mind and their conscience are defiled. They profess that they know God, but by their works they deny him, being abominable and disobedient, and unto every good work reprobate. And that reprobate is unapproved, that it's worthless, that it's not, it doesn't stand the test of God's test. Now, in reference to this, that to the pure, we find that all things are pure, that are pure, they're all pure, but to them that are defiled and unbelieving, nothing is pure. Now, I've thought about this in reference to the matter, whether wrong, correct or not, but I got what brings to my mind. It's all this word. Is the matter that you feel you deal with a fellow that's intoxicated. And he believes that he's just walking straight as a string. But everybody else knows, just by his actions, that he's not. That he is intoxicated. And so even though he thinks that he's okay, and he's walking right, and he's walking upstanding, and everything's going well, everybody around him knows that he's intoxicated, if that's the case. And so we find that in reference to them, that even though they believe that they are doing right, and that they are pure within what they're doing, their their speech will give them up in regard to it. That what they do and how they act, and that's what he said. They think it's pure. They think it's pure. In their mind, they think it is pure. But it's not. And so they deceive themselves in regard to that. And so this is a matter of what God would have us to do, was to seek that purity. What is it? These are characteristics that are developed as a result of the Word of God being applied to our life, and those characteristics that we develop them. You know, David himself, that in the 119th Psalm, when he talked about laying up the Word of God in his heart, that he said that I not sin against thee. Well, how do you keep from sinning against God? Well, first you have to know what sin is, transgression of law. That's what sin is. It is a matter when violate the laws of the land. That's sin. So it's not just a religious term in regard to it, that it deals with lawlessness. And so we know what lawlessness is in the nation within which we live. We know what lawlessness is through our instruction of the Lord, of what the Lord considers to be lawless. And if we will keep that, then we won't have any problem with the laws of the land if we do that. So to the defiled and unbelieving, nothing is pure. And that's evident. So God would have us develop this matter of the purity. And so there, Philippians 4, 8, and 9, he identified that in dealing with that particular matter. All right, we find that the common attitude that existed within the mind of the Jews dealt with one in regards to matter of justifying themselves. That's what they would attempt to do. And in Matthew chapter 5 and verse 21, this is the Sermon on the Mount. Man has dubbed it that, and they did so because Jesus was on the Mount when he preached the sermon. Therefore, and so in chapter 5, 6, and 7, we have in chapter 5, 1, he went to the mount. In chapter 8, 1, he came down from the mount. So with this matter of the Sermon on the Mount, in John chapter 5, in verse 21, we find where the Lord said that ye have heard that it was said of old time, thou shalt not kill. Whosoever shall kill shall be in danger of the judgment. All right, so that's what the law says. Thou shalt not kill, or thou shalt not commit murder is what's involved. But he said, I say unto you that everyone who is angry with his brother shall be guilty of the judgment. And whosoever shall say to his brother, Raca, or that's worthless, shall be in danger of the council. And whosoever shall say, thou fool, shall be in danger of the hell of fire. If therefore thou art offering thy gift on the altar, there remembereth thy brother hath aught against thee, leave there thy gift before the altar and go thy way, first to be reconciled to thy brother, and then come and offer your gift. The matter that, you know, Cain hated Abel. He hated him before he killed him. Right? And so we find that where the law said, thou shalt not kill, thou shalt not commit murder, it goes all the way back to the origin of where it starts. It will start with the hate. It'll start with the envy. It'll start in that particular regard. So even though the Jews could say, well, I didn't kill the guy, therefore, I kept the law. That's basically what it was. I didn't kill him, so I kept the law. But I treated him like a scoundrel. I did everything I could to oppose him, but yet I didn't kill him. Therefore, I kept the law. And so the Lord identifies that the law, you've been told thou shalt not kill, but the Lord said, what? He's not given a new law. What he's given is the intent of that law in regards to the matter that you don't hate. And you have to keep that hate, that anger, that envy. You have to develop an attitude to keep that out of your life. We find that in First John chapter 3 and verse 5, and that or 15, that's what it deals in regards to that of Cain. So I'm not identifying something that the Lord didn't identify. First John chapter 3 and verse 15. For he said in regard to it, whosoever hateth his brother is a murderer. And ye know that no murderer hath eternal life abiding in him. So that's where that connection is made in regard to it. We also find back in Matthew chapter 5 and verse 27 and 28 of adultery, which is the matter of communication among two, one of which is married, at least in regard to that. Otherwise, if it's just two, it's fornication. Deals with just general violation of what God has not authorized. He authorized the marriage, and we'll be looking at that. But in verse 27, he said that you've heard it said, thou shalt not commit adultery. All right, so didn't commit adultery. Wasn't involved in the act. But the Lord's going, just like he did with the matter, thou shalt not commit murder, or thou shalt not kill, he's going to go back to the origin. But I say unto you that everyone that looketh on a woman to lust after her has committed adultery with her already in his heart. And so that's the matter. They would justify it that they didn't go through the act, but they did in regards to their mind. And in these cases, all they lacked is opportunity. And so we find that the Lord dealt with that in regard to it. We find that in Matthew chapter 5, verse 29, so let's blame somebody else. Let's blame God for it. That God gave me the hands to steal with. God gave me the eyes to lust with. And that's what they would do. So they removed themselves from their responsibility. And in verse 29, when he said, if thy right eye causeth thee to stumble, pluck it out and cast it from thee. For it is profitable for thee that one of thy members should perish, and not thy whole body also be cast into hell. So there's the matter. If it's a matter that I lust because God gave me the eyes, Jesus said you'd be better off without. If that's your conclusion, okay, oftentimes folks will use an example and say, well, if that's your conclusion, then here's what the Lord said you'd be better off doing, if you really believe that to be the case. Because sometimes individuals will give a reason, give an example, give an excuse, if you will, for what they do of blaming God. God's the one who created us. He gave us the eyes. He gave us the hands in regard to that. Verse 30, and if thy right hand causeth thee to stumble, cut it off and cast it from thee, for it is profitable for thee that one of thy members should perish and not thy whole body go into hell. And so there's the matters that deals with those principles of the attitude that was used by the Jews of putting off that responsibility. We know we have responsibility. Well, God gave it to us, and in regard to it, as like one fellow told me one time, his attendance was very sporadic, because he was dealing with all of his rental homes that he had on weekends, all he had to work on them. And he said, well, God gave me the homes, and he's therefore going to expect me to keep them up. And so that Sunday's the only time I'm able to do so. So therefore, God's justified him not to do what he's told him to do otherwise. And say, well, if you believe that's the case, maybe you need to get rid of them, you know, because you have other obligations that supersede that particular event. So God's fault, dealing with God or blaming God in regard to that. And so we find that in regards to the matter of purity, in regards to doing that, within God's plan, Genesis 2 and verse 24, God created the man and the woman. He breathed into the man the breath of life. He created the woman, and he created them to cohabit. He told them to go forth and be fruitful and multiply, that you have children. God expected and wanted a populated earth. That's what he wanted. It's all been done for mankind, that God did this in the first place. And so we find that he authorized, you know, talk about marriage. By what authority does a man and a wife, are they allowed in the eyes of God, to dwell together, to cohabit, to have the communication with one another. By what authority does that happen? Well, when God created man, that he identified, in, or Moses did, revealed God's plan, that when God created man, that that he could take a wife, leave his father and mother, cleave to his wife, and they shall become one flesh. What does that mean? It's true that they become united in the areas of purpose and intent, but in 1 Corinthians chapter 6 and verse 16, when the Lord, through the Apostle Paul, identified that when a man goes into a harlot, that he quotes this particular passage when he said in verse 16 of 1 Corinthians chapter 6, when he identified that here was a matter, know ye not, or know ye not that he that is joined to a harlot is one body. Right? Now that this physical communication or communion that they have. For, what does he quote? He quotes what Moses said. The twain, saith he, shall become one flesh. That's what it meant back in Genesis chapter 24. That's what it means in 1 Corinthians chapter 6. And what it does is that God has authorized a man and a woman to join, to become husband and wife. 1 Corinthians chapter 7, concerning the things wherever you wrote, it is good for a man not to touch a woman. But because of fornication, let each man have his own wife, and let the woman have her own husband. And so God has authorized that. And that's why we're able to fulfill that they might become one flesh. That was God's plan. 1 Corinthians 7, 2, each one have his own man, have his own wife, and each woman to have her husband, and that they are to remain undefiled in regard to it. Numbers chapter 5 and verse 11, we find that the defilement that was set forth within the Scripture, and the Lord gives these because of the consequences that's associated with this type of conduct, and there's consequences associated with it. And therefore, Numbers chapter 5 and verse 11, we find where he said, "And Jehovah spake unto Moses, saying, Speak unto the children of Israel, and say unto them, If any man's wife go aside and commit a trespass against him, and the man lie with her carnally, and it be hid from the eyes of her husband, and be kept close, and she be defiled, and there be no witness against her, and she be not taken in the act. And then the spirit of jealousy comes upon the husband." No, it hadn't been caught, but this spirit of jealousy. But the point is that when she goes in to another man that is not her husband, as God has authorized, that she is defiled in regard to that. We find Genesis chapter 34 and verse 5, because what fornication does, it's a matter of being unlicensed, illicit is sometimes the term that is utilized. So in Genesis chapter 34, here we go, Genesis 34 and verse 5. This dealt with Dinah, Jacob, Israel, and Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And so here's Jacob's daughter. Jacob's daughter Dinah, when they went into the land, there was a young man called Shechem that he saw her, and he went unto her, and he defiled her. And so he comes back and says now he wants to marry her, if you will. And so in chapter 34 and verse 5, that it said, "Now Jacob heard that he had defiled," or Shechem had defiled, "Dinah, his daughter, and his sons were with his cattle in the field, and Jacob held his peace until they came." So this is what he had done. This was outside of what God had authorized. Well, through a process of time, Dinah had, because Jacob had, had Leah, Bilhah, and Dinah, whatever the other one was, and Rachel. So these four women is what these children were a result of. The 12 tribes of Israel were a result of that. Dinah had two brothers, Simeon and Levi. And Simeon and Levi, because they had same father, same mother, kind of like Absalom when Amnon had defiled Tamar. You had Absalom and Tamar, same father, same mother. That connection was there. That connection was also made between Simeon and Levi. And so the agreement was made with Jacob that they could become united if the people of Shechem, the men of Shechem, were circumcised. That's the only way they could have any connection with them. And so that's what they did. And in the third day, when those men were sore and could not get about, Simeon and Levi went in and killed them all. All right, that had its consequences. But the point, because he had defiled their sister, is what he had done in regard to it. That was not licensed. It was not according to the will of God. And therefore we find the term pollute, or to be unclean, is what he identifies. And so the body is something to keep pure, but because of today's teaching, or lack thereof, if you will, the resting of divine terms among the young and the old are sacrificing the eternal on the altar of the immediate, whatever appeals to them at the time. And it's interesting to note of how they will define it, that no matter what, one of the definitions is if they don't go all the way, okay, then there's no transgression. And that's what's how society has justified the illicit activity among the young, and also that of the old in regard to it. All right, so there's a matter of one of them that deals with what God would have us to be and what he would help others to be. To be pure, to be without defilement. And so when we go through life and we find ourselves that we've defiled ourselves, or whatever the case is, the blood of Christ, that's where that comes in, that he will remit us from all transgression. And says that God will remember it no more. Said, well, God can't, he knows everything. He will not remember it in judgment. It will not be brought about in the judgment of mankind. And that's covered through the blood of Christ. We put our confidence, our faith, and our hope, and our trust in the Lord, that we have the assurance that we will not be brought before the judgment seat of Christ with those things laid to our account. And we can stand before God pure and undefiled. All right, we have a song that we want to sing, and we reflect upon the matters of what God has done, the message, true and glad. When we ring it out, that's what God would have us to do.